Welcome to a special Infotagem podcast series following the work of the Joint Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill in the UK Parliament. I chair the committee, and in this series, we'll be looking each week at the evidence the committee has received as it works to prepare its final report by the 10th of December. That report will make recommendations to the UK Parliament and government on amendments that should be made to the Draft Online Safety Bill before it is introduced to Parliament in the new year. For the first public meeting of the committee on Thursday, the 9th of September, we took evidence from a range of organisations and individuals who all have experience of dealing with the harm that content can do online, the harm that hate speech can cause and the victims of that speech, and discussing how that should be regulated in online spaces like social media platforms. On the first panel, we heard from Imran Ahmed, who is the chief executive of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, which has done a large amount of research into networks of hate speech and conspiracy theories on social media platforms. And first up, Imran told us that we should focus not just so much on the content itself, but the systems created by the platforms that help that content reach wide audiences. And we can hear from Imran now.
I think that the system they've built is one that is perfect for the dissemination of misinformation that recolors the lens through which people see the world and leads them down radicalization pathways. But that the bad actors would have done it anyway. And in one part, it's not just about, you know, you've got this ideal system for them. It's also that there are these bad actors that are experts at weaponizing their spaces, and they tolerate their presence. And really the question is, why do they tolerate their presence? And we do have answers to that. You know, Twitter is used for discourse shaping. It's used to target journalists, target politicians, tell them what the acceptable bounds of discourse are until you get abuse. And that has an effect over time. I mean, all of us here at some point will have been abused online, and you know that it gets to you eventually. There's evidence points. YouTube and Facebook and Instagram are used as evidence points. So you put up your evidence there, and then that's fed into other radicalization environments, which you use to contextually reshape the way you see the world. All these platforms come together, you know, it's sort of like Lego, and eventually what you have is a palace that is ideal for bad actors to use.
Darren Jones, MP, asked Imran Ahmed about the research CCDH had done into the disinformation dozen, the major distributors of anti-vaccine conspiracy theories related to the COVID pandemic.
Imran, I'm interested in the identification of the 12 individuals, because often the tech companies will say, well, there's millions of pieces of content, we have warehouses of content moderators, AI systems, it's very difficult to find everything. But you've managed to hone it down to 12 individuals, which makes it sound quite easy to just get rid of them. I mean, presumably they have multiple identities. Is it more than 12? What, if it's down to 12, why are the companies not dealing with them at the root source?
So, I mean, keeping in mind that Facebook have responded to disinformation dozen now, I think Monica Bickett, 5 months after our report came out, who's their vice president of content policy, and about a month after President Biden had accused them. I'm just trying to find the statistics now that we have on the number of accounts. So those 12 individuals, actually some of them are couples, and behind them are a network of 501c3s, charities, LLCs. They all own companies which have millions of dollars of revenue. These aren't just 12 random members of the public. These are sophisticated bad actors. They have 97 accounts between them. Now, Monica Bickett said, CCDH's research is nonsense because there are lots and lots of people who are spreading misinformation. That's true. But these 12 people are the super spreaders. They sit, they're nodes in a network. And online spaces are different. They're not flat spaces. They're hierarchical in terms of who are the key influencers. I have 5,500 followers. If I tweet something, 5,500 people might see it. If they tweet something, a couple of million people might see it because they have far more followers than I do. Of those 97 accounts, only 47 as of right now have been removed. So even though they know the 97 accounts, they failed to take down over half of them. They currently still have 7.9 million followers between the 12 of them. 6.3 million have been taken down. Now, look, that's not bad. I'm glad that 6.3 million followers, that 47 of their accounts have been taken down. I'm very proud that my organization has driven that work. However, the job's not done.
We then heard from Baroness Kidron, who asks Imran Ahmed about the profit that is made from harmful content and the fact that the companies are aware this content exists and that it's good for their engagement business model.
I was really interested when the chair asked you a question and sort of said, you know, is it set up to spread this bad stuff? And you actually were quite careful and you sort of backtracked and said, no, actually, it's a perfect environment. Mm. So I think I'd like you to tell the committee, given that you're our first witness, should we be looking at the intention and unintentional consequences of this system? Is that one of the things we need to do?
So I'm always really cautious when it comes to ascribing the reasons for harm. When I'm asked about the disinformation dozen, and the most frequent question I get asked is, are they doing this on purpose? Are they doing this for the money? And I say, I cannot tell you what resides in the hearts of people, but I can tell you it's curious how much money they make from spreading disinformation. And so I would say the same about the executives of these companies. However, they know, they have been told many, many times, not just by us, civil society, not just by governments, but also internally by their own staff. Shira Frenkel's marvelous new book on Facebook shows you the extent to which there is internally, there are people pushing back, saying, please, you know, we need to do something about these harms. I can tell you right now that I speak to people inside these companies, and they are frustrated at the fact that their executives know about this and are doing little about it. We have worked with, so I've on the DCMS Counter Disinformation Task Force set up around COVID. I mean, that was four civil society, so four charities or non-profit NGOs, a few academics, some civil servants, ministers, and the companies. And we were giving them all the data. We were telling them what was going on. There was one point at which I think Facebook's representative thanked us all for the work that we'd done identifying the problems on their platform. And because I'm pokey, I poked back and said, we have hundreds of thousands of dollars of revenue between the four organizations. You have billions. Why on earth aren't you doing this work for yourself?
On the second panel, we focused on the issue of racist abuse directed at sports stars, particularly footballers. And the witnesses were Rio Ferdinand, the former England and Manchester United international footballer, along with Edeline John from the Football Association and Sanjay Bhandari from the organisation Kick Racism Out of Football. And we'll hear now from Rio Ferdinand as he addresses the concern that racist abuse online is giving a licence for racist abuse offline as well. And this is directed at people across sports, both online and in their real lives.
Just finally, from me, I mean, are you concerned, Maria Ferdinand, are you concerned that the prevalence of this speech, this content, this dehumanising language on social media is giving licence to racists, effectively, to speak out, to seek other people of similar opinions and to act in a concerted way to deliberately target and dehumanise sports stars like, you know, footballers?
100% I agree with that. I think it's normalising racist behaviour. It's normalising racist language. If you put it in a context of a young person who supports, admires a certain player, whatever level that is, whatever football club they support, and he's looking through that feed and seeing racist language, or that player now is not his favourite player because he missed a penalty maybe, and he's seeing the racist language that is now being put towards that person that he's now not in favour, that normalises that type of language. So that young person then goes into his network of friends either on social media platforms or face-to-face, and he's seen it, and it's not been... There's no repercussions for that for the person who put that online. It's fine, it's normal. So I'll do that at school, and I'll say it at school. It's okay. When there's no repercussions, there's nothing going to be done to actually put that person in place, put that person in the spotlight, take them from behind that curtain to expose them as to who they are, spouting this ridiculous language, ignorant language, then people are going to find it and think it's normal. And I think I don't know what other industries there are in the world where it's okay to spout such language and be okay and get away with it and be able to hide behind the curtain as we do online.
Lord Gilbert asked Sanjay Bhandari about how we distinguish between content that is already illegal and therefore would want to see the law enforced against that content online as we would offline. How we contrast that content with content that is considered harmful but is not necessarily illegal. and whether we need to specify in the bill particular series of areas of content which would fall into that category of being harmful but not necessarily illegal.
It's just a quick question, actually. I just want clarity about one of the things you're very specifically asking for in this bill. I think the question is probably for Sanjay. So the things you've been describing, some of the behaviour you've been describing is illegal and ought to be dealt with, and the duty of care requiring platforms to take down illegal content. I don't know about you, I'm reasonably optimistic that that's substantial progress. Some of it is not illegal. And you said you would like it much clearer on the face of the bill, a much clearer definition on the face of the bill of harmful content that incorporates the kind of material that you're describing, the kind of behaviour that you're describing. It seems to me there are two ways of doing that. Either describing that on the face of the bill as content that is harmful but is still legal, and therefore it gets caught up by the duty of care, or just stop pussyfooting around and make it illegal. And which of those approaches do you favour?
Neither. I'm suggesting something in the middle, which is because the approach that you've suggested is static. That doesn't deal with the dynamism of evolving language and the evolving language of social media. If we just froze in time what is happening now and the abuse we see now, we'll be back asking for more primary legislation every time people change their behaviour online. That won't work. What I think we need to do, and we'll happily come back with some more detailed suggestions, is that you need to give Ofcom the power to regulate harmful but on its face legal content. So we'll give you an example. I think our guiding light in this should be the abuse that the three players received after the UEFA Euro 2020 final, because the unified public condemnation of that says to us that what the public are demanding is that each and every piece of hate that was spat out that night needs to be taken off the platforms.
On the third panel for the evidence session that day, we heard from Nancy Kelly, the chief executive of Stonewall, and Danny Stone from the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust. And here we touched on the important issue of anonymity. To what extent does anonymity protect the victim from abuse rather than the abuser from being prosecuted and charged for targeting somebody with vile hate speech and abuse? Should anonymity continue to exist in an absolute form on social media?
Where do you see the anonymity as part of this bill? I mean, do you think there's enough to tackle that? And also, do you see that that's one of the challenges here, that you might have one person with 20 identities spreading hate to millions of people?
It's an issue that isn't really addressed in the bill properly. I mean, anonymity certainly was in the white paper, that there would be address for anonymity. There's nothing at the moment. I mean, people in this house, Siobhan Bailey, Margaret Hodge, have called for verification systems so that one can engage only with verified accounts. We'd actually go further and say, make it the platform's problem. They should be liable where they can't provide the details of an individual, where there's a sufficient, where there's a burden of proof and there's sufficient evidence and a limited revelation of that data. You should be able to find out, as you can in financial services, the Know Your Customer principle, who's responsible. That said, I know that there are important kind of, you know, there must be important protections for those that are victims of domestic abuse, whistleblowers, and those who would like to come out but are frightened to give their details, or who have parents who may be concerned about that for whatever reason. There will be various reasons why anonymity is precious, and perhaps middleware or perhaps trusted partners who can be middle people with that data might be a solution.
Just to say a couple of things, but mostly I'll talk a bit about anonymity because I suspect it's one of the areas where Stonewall's perspective differs, particularly from an international protection perspective. I think it's possible to regulate a lot of the behaviours you're describing without knowing the individual identity of the account, is the first thing that I would say. So accounts that are behaving in a particular way can be identified without knowing who the account owner is.
So looking back across the whole of that first evidence session, I'm joined by Baroness Kidron to discuss what we heard and the significance for the inquiry. Now, Bibel, I wanted to ask you about the first evidence session we heard for the Joint Committee, and in particular, how you categorise content that is harmful but is not necessarily illegal for the terms of the bill, and whether we need to have a special definition or whether actually we can use existing laws like the Equalities Act, which does try to define categories of content which would be illegal. And I mean, you had a very interesting idea about whether a general duty and responsibility should be placed on social media companies to enforce existing legislation like the Equalities Act online.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really interesting point. And in fact, the way that it came out through Imran's testimony was really fascinating. But I think that it speaks to something very profound, which is this idea that we've had for the last decade or two, that this is a sort of exceptional space rather than a space in which we live, work, dream, participate. And I think that I take the view that it's not exceptional and that, in fact, we have made many complex arrangements with each other about how best to live. And they are imperfect, but they actually have quite a lot to offer. So the idea of having an objective to deliver on the Equality Act on and offline equally seems like a no-brainer to me. Just like I would say, and I hope others will say, that the bill has to deliver on children's rights, on and offline equally. They don't live in one place or another place. They live in both places. And so I think that if the bill is going to be clear that actually borrowing as much as possible from democratically agreed and long-lasting arrangements that actually profoundly work is a much better place to go than everybody making up their own rules for themselves.
And I think many people would question why this isn't already the case, why in some ways this requires this new piece of legislation simply to enforce the law.
I think that that's true, and I have historically suggested a harmonisation bill that basically says unless it doesn't, you should assume all legislation applies online. And actually, I think there's something to be said for that. But I think we are here with the bill, and I think that this conversation around the Equality Act actually did reveal something else, which is, largely speaking, the safety objectives of the bill are supported, by a broad group of people. And in fact, coming up in the next podcast, I'm sure, but, seeing the evidence from SNAP today, they make the point that the objectives of the bill should be supported by a general duty of care. So I think if we are clearer about all the objectives and say, okay, that covers the waterfront, yeah, you have a duty of care to get to that point. Yeah, that's enough. And these sort of secondary duties are not 100% waterproof. Future-proof, and they sort of create places, to contest. And that really, really worries me. So I like the idea of really clear objectives. I like the idea that they should be recognizable as things that we've already agreed, not a new frontier of coming into people's lives and telling them what to think. I like the idea that they should be recognizable. And then this idea of a duty of care to make sure your services at a systemic level are working towards those objectives. And I thought that was the other big takeaway from our first session, was everybody said, please, systems and processes, not individual pieces of content.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it was very interesting to hear from Edeline John from the Football Association, a very powerful evidence she gave to the committee, but how sometimes the platforms can treat someone who is the multiple victim of abuse as the problem rather than the victims, and that someone had their social media account suspended because they'd complained too many times, even though each time they complained, it was totally legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was extraordinary. And I think probably in the moment you saw my reaction, that I actually said, are you really saying this? Because it is preposterous. And I think that, speaking with you know, my own personal experience. A lot of parents come to me and ask me to represent them with the tech companies. And the vast majority of them are asking for answers, are asking for information, are asking for action. And these are after quite terrible things. Tragic things have happened. And I think that that sort of speaks to a sort of broader thing, which I will be interested to see, you know, what the evidence comes up with in the course of our committee inquiry. But, you know, you can't just say, make it up and we'll check you, say what you do. I think we do need minimum standards. And I think that one thing that is really important, you know, to say overall is, you know, is this is not about everybody being goody two shoes. This is actually about what the baseline is. So if a parent who's had a child who's been a victim of something terrible, or indeed has taken their own life or has some issue, wants to talk to the tech companies and get answers, I think there has to be a minimum requirement that they get back, that they deal with it in a human way, and that whatever their legal defense, that the parent has some support in this system to say, no, I shouldn't have to go get a lawyer to try and find out what my child was looking at on the day they died.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And that's, from my experience, the consistent complaint you get is just how difficult it is to get really basic and important information for serious cases like that. I think this question came up in the first session as well about what do the companies have the technical capability to do? You know, because how possible is it to look at real-time enforcement? You know, why was it that when the England footballers were abused after the game against Italy, it wasn't just that racist abuse was on the platforms, but the platforms were highlighting it as trending topics of information people might be interested in. And I think Rio Ferdinand was right to make the point that, you know, if you try and post pirated footage of a football goal being scored, it comes down pretty quick. And I have had live experience of this on Saturday. I took my 12-year-old son to watch our local team, Folkestone Invicta, play in the non-league on Saturday. And it was the same time as Manchester United were playing Newcastle and Ronaldo made his comeback. So I tried to look up to see Ronaldo's first goal and instantly saw a post where Twitter had flagged this content is not available in your territory. And so that shows within seconds, you can identify something that shouldn't be there and remove it. You can do it for something commercial, like the rights around a football goal, but not for the sort of vile abuse that people get.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think if we, you know, do one thing only as a committee, I think we've got to shake out this, it's not technically possible. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is historically, you know, the tech sector has said, it's not technically possible to have GDPR. It's not technically possible to have the age-appropriate design code. It's not technically possible to have two-factor authentication. These things, you know, we will fall over if you impose these requirements. And actually, history shows that it is technically possible. You know, regulation has to say this is what we expect. And this is an industry, let's face it, that's getting us to Mars, theoretically. It is technically possible. The question is, you know, really about governance. And I think that we're going to find this coming up again and again. And it's particularly going to come up when we get to the piece around age assurance. The problem with age assurance, that is checking someone's estimated age or actual age, is that we have no governance framework saying it must be private, it must be easy to use, it must not share data, et cetera, rather than it's not technically possible. So I think that, you know, Rio's point was really well made, you know, whenever, and I think it's worth looking at it, whenever money is in the system, yeah, so IP, gambling money, you know, e-commerce and so on, you know, they immediately put in protections for them and discriminations about different kinds of content and users and so on. And whether it's when it's for these more societal or ensuring user equity, it's technically impossible. So I think we got to get rid of that. That's a smokescreen. And I think that the bill is really, you know, the government's opportunity to say, this is what you have to do, now go away and do it.
And I think you'll find that it is easily done.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us for this podcast, and look forward to seeing you at the next evidence session.
Fantastic.
Thank you for listening to this special Infotagem podcast series following the work of the Joint Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill. This podcast will give you a weekly update on the work of the committee up to the publication of its report on the 10th of December. Thank you for listening. Until next time.